The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, around this time of year, my greatest hopes had to do with what I was getting for Christmas. And my greatest fears were that it was going to be underwear. That's were my hopes and fears. What are your greatest hopes and fears today, though? Here we are. We're grown-ups now. What are your greatest hopes? What are your deepest fears? Because as you get older, you start to realize that your hopes and fears, they don't revolve around toys and gifts as much, in spite of the fact that Black Friday and Cyber Monday might say otherwise. We know that whatever we buy on weekends like this doesn't really satisfy our hopes and doesn't really solve our fears. Our hopes and fears revolve around meaning and purpose and relationships and rescue, redemption, something that would make this life worthwhile, that would redeem it for all of its pain and trouble and suffering and difficulty, right? We're afraid there won't be more to life. We hope that there's going to be purpose to it all. We hope for loving relationships. We're afraid that when the season ends, the joy will be over and that'll be it. It'll just be not white Christmas, but snow again, right? Those are the things we hope and fear. Hopes and fears are heavy, especially this time of year. This morning, I want to tell you a story about a woman in the Bible named Naomi, whose life was full of hope and fear. When we meet her, Naomi's life is full and she is satisfied. Things are going well. She's got a wonderful husband and she has two beautiful sons, and they have a nice property and farm and land in a small town called Bethlehem. It's small, but it's fertile, and it's a great place to raise a family and build a life together, and things are going great for her. But then a famine hits, and they don't have a backup plan. Their land begins to fail. They have no choice but to sell it to someone in order to survive. And then they have to decide, you know what, we sold our land, we have this money, but it's not going to last forever. We don't know how long the famine's going to last. We've got to just go. And so they leave their home, they leave their country, and they move their whole family to another country named Moab to hopefully find work and life. And that there are a lot of us here who have that very same story, aren't there? Who have picked up and moved. You've made that same decision to move to a different country, this country, in order to take advantage of some kind of opportunity that you maybe didn't have where you came from. And if that's not true for you, it's probably true for your parents or your grandparents sitting here today, that we've picked up at some point and moved to another country. So we connect with this. Moving to Moab gave them hope of surviving and maybe thriving, but it also brought a lot of fear. Because the Israelites and the Moabites, well, they didn't have a good history together. They didn't get along. So going into that country meant that they were going to be probably looked down on. They were going to experience bigotry. They were going to have to take whatever work someone would give them, the way many people do when they move to a different country. You may have an education level that puts you in the place of being a doctor or a nurse, but you find yourself cleaning floors and doing other things like that, not using the skills you've learned, right? That happens all the time, and that's what they were looking forward to, but just maybe they could go there and build a new life and get through all of that, and they'd be okay. It's kind of funny how hopes and fears fit together that way. They work hand in hand. And they were making it work, Naomi and her three men, because her boys started to get older and become more like men, and she had her husband, she had her boys, and it was starting to look hopeful, like they were going to be okay, until one of Naomi's worst fears came true. Her husband died, leaving her alone with her two boys. Can you imagine how heart-wrenching that would be, to be so far from home, so far from family, so far from friends and any support network, and your husband dies? And for her, that meant he was the source of income. He was her source of protection in those days, talking thousands of years ago, different world. And now she's got to just lean on her two boys. And as they get older and become men, she finds wives for them and they marry a couple Moabite women. And okay, maybe there's still some hope here. Maybe there's still some chance that we'll be okay. Years go by, her sons and their wives aren't having any kids, but Naomi would gladly trade the fear of not having grandchildren right away with the fear of not surviving. So they feel like they're doing okay until Naomi's next greatest fear comes true, and both her sons die. And now she has nothing. No one to protect her, no one to provide, no one to care, no one to shelter her in a world that's cruel to women. So she tells the two daughters-in-law, please just go. Please just leave me. There's no hope. I have no hope. There's no hope in my life. I have no hope for you. Just go back to your families. You'd be better off there. There's nothing I can give you. There's no hope in staying with me. What's going to happen? Do you think I'm going to get married again? Maybe somehow miraculously have a baby at my age, and then you're going to wait for that baby to grow up, and is that your hope? You're going to sit here and hope that I'll have a baby and that baby will grow up and then take care of you? Redeem your life? No, just go. Go back to your parents and build a new life. And one of them does, and that she's not wrong to do it, but she does. And the other refuses. The other says, no, I'm going to stay with you. And her name is Ruth. And Ruth says to her, listen to what she says. She says, do not urge me to leave. Don't urge me to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Wherever you stay, I will stay. Your people are my people. Your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There I'll be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely. In other words, may God just strike me dead. If even death separates you and me. I think probably one of our greatest hopes in life is to have someone who loves us the way Ruth loves her mother-in-law, Naomi. To have someone who would say that and stand by us that way. Because what Ruth is saying is, I am committed to you. And look, not because my hope is in you, not because you're going to have a baby and I'll be able to marry that baby when he grows up and then redeem my life and everything. No, my hope is in you because my hope is in your God. I put my hope in your God. And even though you may have lost all hope in God right now, I'm going to keep putting my hope in the Lord because he's put me here with you. So Naomi decides, okay, fine. She's not going to argue with her about it. And she heads back to Bethlehem where she came from. It's the only thing she knows. So she heads back that way and Ruth goes with her. And they travel all that way. The famine's over at this point, but they still don't have a home there. She's just hoping maybe something good will happen. And so they get back to the town and the women see her and they say, is that you, Naomi? Is that you? Because the years have probably worn her down quite a bit at this point. Is that you? Come back to us? And they listen to what Naomi says, because you've probably felt the way she feels in this moment, or you know someone who has, because she looks at them and says, please, please, no, my name's not Naomi anymore, because Naomi means pleasant. It's no, my name now is Mara, because Mara means bitter. It's like, just change my name. Change my name, because my life is that old life is gone. That life where I was full and had what I needed and was blessed, that life is gone. My name is now Mara, because I am bitter and empty. Nothing good has come my way, only evil. I have nothing. I mean, she's not empty. She doesn't have nothing. There's Ruth standing by her side. Ruth's not chopped liver. I wonder what Ruth is thinking as she says this, but Ruth stays devoted to her. And that's one of the things about us. Sometimes we get so focused on our fears that we can't see the hope that's standing right next to us. Some of you may be there today. Listen to what happens in this story. Because to be fair to Naomi, there were a lot of things still to be afraid of. It's not like she can just go back to her home and walk in and settle in. No, it's not her home anymore. She can walk by it and see someone else living there. It's not her land. She has nothing. They gave it all up during the famine. They sold it. And they don't have the money to buy it back. She can't redeem it herself. She has no way to redeem her own life and land. Her hopes and fears revolve around there being someone who would rescue her from the place she's in. Someone to redeem that land and give her a new beginning. But right now she's so down, she's so frozen in fear She can't do anything. So thank God for Ruth. Ruth keeps her hope in God, and that keeps them going. They get there to Bethlehem, and it's right about the time of the barley harvest, and Naomi's just, you know, laying down wherever she found to lay down and doesn't want to do anything. And Ruth says to her, let me go to the fields, and I'll just pick whatever leftover grain there is. I'll go get some food somewhere. Just, you know, I'm going to go out and do that. And Naomi's just, go ahead. Let's her go. Well, why not go with her? Why not get up and go with her? She's capable. She just walked all that way from Moab to back to Bethlehem. She's not physically unable, but she's just so weighed down by her hopelessness and her fear. And she won't even lift a finger to help herself. I've been there. Have you been there? Do you feel that way ever? Hopeless that the thing, your life, and all the stuff you're trying to do is just not going to work out. Whatever. Let me just sit here and watch TV. That's what our hopelessness does, and we quit. Ruth, though, she still has hope. She still trusts in the Lord, so she goes out to work. She goes to a field, and they had some very interesting and great laws in Israel that God gave them that said whoever owns a field, and they were harvesting barley at the time, it said don't harvest all the way to the edges of your field. Leave a margin. Leave a margin of space in there, leave a margin of crop that's unharvested so that those who are poor, those who are in situations like Ruth and Naomi, so that they can go and harvest themselves and get some food and work and earn that food and do what they need to do. It's a way of taking care of them. And so that's what Ruth does. And she goes and she's harvesting the edges of the field, and the boss shows up, the owner of the field shows up, and this could be really bad. His name is Boaz. That sounds like it could be a mean name, doesn't it? Boaz. But he shows up, and this could be bad because, look, she's not Jewish. She's Moabite, which means they don't like her, typically, because the Jews and the Moabites don't get along. And she has no man to protect her or speak for her. No one to answer to if anyone were to decide, I'm going to go rape her. I'm going to go take advantage of her. I'm going to force her to do my work for me. Like, no one to answer to if they do that to her. Boaz shows up, and he could kick her out. He could do all kinds of things. But he sees her there. He asks about her. And then he calls her over, and he says, look, you know, stay here. It's a good thing you've come to my field. Stay here. Work this field, right? And he tells all of his workers, you leave her alone. You watch out for her. You protect her. And in fact, he tells them, I want you to like pull some of the extra stuff and like just drop it so it's easier for her to collect what she needs. And he tells her, look, just whenever you need water, go to our well and get water. Whatever you need, you stay here. You keep coming back here every day. And when they have lunch during the day, he calls her over and he gives her extra grain and things he needs. And he tells her why. He says he's heard about her. He knows what she has done for her mother-in-law. And he says to her, may the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. See, Boaz is helping her, and he makes it clear, this isn't me helping you. I honor and respect God, and so I'm just doing what God is telling me to do. God is the one who is rewarding you and taking care of you because you put your hope in him and stayed faithful to Naomi and stuck by her side. So Ruth goes home, tells Naomi what happened, gives all this food that she had that they gave her, and all of a sudden Naomi's tune changes, right? Sometimes just that little thing good has to happen and you get excited. But this is a big thing actually that happened, and Ruth didn't know how big it was. Naomi's like, oh my goodness, the Lord, he has, you know, not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. Where before she hated God. She actually told her friends, nope, God's done this to me. And she won't even talk about God, really. She says, the Almighty One. Like, she uses words that distance herself from God. He has inflicted me. I went away full. Now I'm back. I came back empty. He has made my life bitter and miserable. Now she's like, oh, he hasn't forgot me after all. His kindness didn't end. And here's why she's so excited. It's because Boaz is one of the two people in Bethlehem who stands in line where it's possible to redeem her property for her, to redeem her life. He's one of two people in Bethlehem who could do it, who could buy back her property for her. her home for her. And Ruth just happened to wander into his field. And he just happened to go out that day to see what was going on and check on everyone and notice her and then be an honorable, good, godly man and reward her. So Ruth goes back day after day for the harvest, working under the protection of Boaz. But that's not enough for Naomi. Naomi thinks there could be more here, right? Her hope is that someone will redeem her life, and she sees a way to get it. So she takes Ruth, and she dresses her up and does her makeup and everything, and says, here's what you got to do, and then describes what she needs to do in order to go and effectively propose marriage to Boaz. That's effectively what she does. And so she tells her, you need to go, and when, you know, everyone's threshing at the floor, and then they're done with all the work for the day, they're going to lay down and go to sleep. You go over to Boaz, and you uncover his feet, and you lay there. It's a way of saying, I want to come under the protection, like under your skirts, right? And so she, I don't know how many of you would do this, but she goes dressed up and smelling all pretty and all that. And he falls asleep, and she sneaks over, and she lays down on the floor and just uncovers his feet, and she lays there. And he wakes up, and they all knew what this meant. There's a whole lot of stuff going on here that we maybe don't quite understand because these aren't our customs. They would be kind of odd today. But he sees her, and he's like, oh, my goodness. That, because he's older. And obviously, she's not chasing after some young man, or she's in every step, trusting God and doing whatever she can to honor her mother-in-law. And so she basically is proposing marriage. In a world where that would just be so odd and unusual, she's proposing marriage to him. And he's willing, except there's a problem. He's not first in line to redeem the property that belonged to Naomi's husband and then sons, which means he's not first in line to marry Ruth. There's someone else. And so he gives her a bunch of food and sends her back to Naomi and says, I'll take care of this. And she goes home and tells Naomi, and Naomi says, just wait. He's going to take care of this today. I knew I did your makeup right. He'll take care of this today. So Boaz goes to the gates of the city, which is like where they have court. It's like the courtroom for the town. And he waits there, and he gathers some of the elders enough that they can make a decision or witness a contract happen. And then he waits for this other guy to come who stands in line to be what they would call, in your Bible, you'll see it's called a kinsman redeemer. Someone who's related to Naomi's husband and sons who stands in the line to say, yes, I'll buy back that property in his name, because that's what they would do. They'd buy it back in her son's name, effectively, since her husband had died, but he had sons. They'd buy back the property in her son's name, but that also would mean they'd have to make a few other commitments. So Boaz waits. The guy comes, and he says, hey, come here. I want to talk to you. And he says, here's the deal. Boaz's wife and the mother of his two sons is here, and she needs someone to redeem her property. You stand first in line to do that. You can buy back, and now you'll own his property, and you can have it. And the man says, well, yeah, absolutely. I'll get that property. And they says, now hold on. You just need to know the whole picture, because there's some things attached. Because Naomi's son had a wife, and she's here, but they didn't have any children, which means that if you buy back the land, you also need to take her as a wife. She's a Moabite, by the way. And it means you'll have to, your first son with her will carry the name of her first husband, not your name. And he inherits all of that. And now the guy's like, whoa, okay, wait a minute. Now think about this. One, do I want to marry a Moabite woman? I'm not sure I want to do that. I'm not sure what my parents would say. Two, now I'm kind of extending myself and putting my own properties in jeopardy. He thinks about it, and says, you know what? No, that's all right. Never mind. You go ahead and you do it. And he gives him a shoe because that's how they made contracts. And so Boaz buys back the property, redeems it, redeems Naomi's home for her, gives it back to her, and her land, and gives it back to her. What's more, he marries Ruth, and they have a son, together. And they name that son Obed. And all the women of the town come shouting, Naomi has a son, because in effect, this son that Ruth and Boaz just had is considered the replacement for Naomi's son who died. He is the one who now is seen as her protector, guardian, redeemer, who will grow up to watch over her in her old years, to make sure she has a place, make sure she has a home, make sure she's cared for. This child born there in Bethlehem was the one who would redeem her life and give her a hope for a future again. And all the women of the town are shouting and praising God for her. The hopes and fears of all Naomi's years were met in Bethlehem that night when Obed was born. Now, of course, there's more to this story. And many of you are running in your heads like, oh, Jesus was born in Bethlehem. I know it. I know it. Jesus was born in Bethlehem too. These stories, though, are not just connected because of that. These stories are directly connected. Let me just show this to you because I want us to appreciate how amazing our God is and how amazing God's word is and how amazing these stories are when you really dig in and recognize and see what's going on. You see, Obed grew up and had a son named Jesse. Ring a bell to anybody? Jesse had a son named, who call it out, you know it. David, right. David became the king of Israel. God sent his prophet Samuel one day to anoint David to be king over Israel, to bring hope to Israel and drive out their fears. Do you know where that was? Bethlehem. God gave hope to Israel through King David. And he established Israel as a great nation, fought off all her enemies, and drove away all the things they were afraid of. And it's just, to me, amazing to think that God took all the troubles, all the fears and hopelessness of Naomi and turned them into the reign of King David, the greatest king Israel ever knew. How God took Ruth, a woman from another country, a Moabite, as someone who Jewish people didn't even like, who lost her husband, who had nothing ahead of her, who just pledged herself to put her hope in God and stand by this woman's side, her mother-in-law's side. And God made her the great-grandmother of the greatest king Israel ever knew. How the greatest king Israel ever knew wasn't, you think of kings, you think, oh, the purity of the line, right? You think of, like, you know, England now, and you know, you got to keep the bloodlines pure. The great-grandmother of the greatest king of Israel was a Moabite, not even Jewish. Oh, but wait, there's more. There's another thing to this story that's a little bit of a twist and unusual. Boaz has a crazy backstory too. Boaz's bloodline isn't pure either. Do you remember the story of Israel and the walls of Jericho? You know, they march around the walls for 7 days, and then the seventh day they march around seven times. Well, you remember the spies went in to try and figure out, where is there a weakness here? And they're almost about to get caught and someone rescues them. Do you remember who that was? It was a prostitute named Rahab. Yeah, who's clinging to life, living on the wall, literally, selling herself to get by. She puts her hope in God, helps those two spies, and she and her family are the only ones who survive when the day comes that God's judgment falls on Jericho. Well, she married someone, joined the Israelites, married someone there, and she had a son. Do you know what that son's name is? Boaz. So God takes these people who aren't even Jewish, right? Because God, some people get this so confused and we think, oh, God has his special people. No, God doesn't choose special people to say, oh, I like you more than everybody else. God chooses people to say, I'm going to use you to bring hope to everyone else. That's why God chose them. And so God takes this Canaanite woman and this Moabite woman and makes them the ancestors of the greatest king Israel ever knew. That's how God works. But wait, there's actually more still, like an infomercial here. You know the genealogies in the Bible that you always skip over because they're boring to read and you don't know any of the names anyway and can't say them? Well, when you get to the Gospel of Matthew and you read in chapter 1 the genealogy that leads to Jesus, guess whose names are in it? Boaz, Ruth, Obed, Jesse, David, and Rahab's name is there too. See, after David died, Israel longed for a day when God would give them a king like David that would satisfy their hopes and get away and drive away all their fears. They cried for God to bring David back. And on the night Jesus was born, in a feeding trough, in a place where animals normally stayed, in this little town called Bethlehem, the hopes and fears of all the years were met there by Jesus in Bethlehem that night. Not just the hopes and fears of the past, of the Naomis and the Rahabs and the Boazes and the Ruths, but the hopes and fears of all the years. There is a Redeemer, a guardian for us all. That's what Jesus' birth means to you and to me, for you and for me, and for the people you work with, and live side by side with, and travel with every day. There is a Redeemer, a guardian to rescue and protect, to give purpose and meaning to life, to redeem these lives of ours. There's someone who can redeem our lives and bring us home and give us a new beginning. Our hopes and fears are met by Jesus. I read an article the other day by this guy named Lee Eckloff, and he was talking about how a friend of his gave him a gift. It was a little cross decorated nice, and on it was an inscription that said, "Hope raises no dust." And he took it and said, that's really deep. And he tried to penetrate the mystery of that saying, and he couldn't. He felt like it said something to his heart, but he didn't understand what it actually meant. Hope raises no dust. But he didn't want to look stupid, so he didn't ask. Instead, he went home and went to his computer and Google, typed it in there, and found out that it's a saying from a French poet named Paul Eluard, who was associated with Dadaism. And so, okay, well, what's Dadaism, right? So he said, okay, what's Dadaism? And this is the definition. He said, the Dada movement tried to express the negation of all current aesthetic and social values and frequently used deliberately incomprehensible artistic and literary methods. Got it? Okay, so here's a couple examples of some quotes from Dada that give you, show you. One is, elephants are contagious. Get it? Okay, let's try another one. Earth is blue like an orange. Right, the whole point of Dadaism is just to deconstruct everything, kind of to point out that there's really not meaning. A meaning is just what you attach to things. And so that brought him back to this, hope raises no dust. What does that mean? And here's what he reflected on it. Everyone you talk to is thinks about hope. They pray for hope. They talk about hope, right? We use the word hope all the time. You'll see it on decorations everywhere you go for the next few weeks. But when it comes down to it, if you to really dig in, what are we hoping in? It's just this nebulous, cloudy thing. It's just hope. I just hope. And it's not rooted in anything real or concrete. But for Christians, hope is not vague. If you're a follower of Jesus, hope is not some vague thing. We have a hope that is historic and personal and real, flesh and blood. We have a hope that started by stirring up the dust of a manger and ended by shaking off the dust of the grave. Hope isn't afraid to get dirty. Hope raises no dust. No, hope raises literally a hell of a lot of dust, because hope raises hell and knocks it down and breaks us free from the sickness and death, the coating of dirt that is on us. It redeems our lives when we were hopeless. Ruth's hope was not in just this idea of kindness. Oh, I just hope in kindness. That's what I hope, and I hope in kindness. No. Her hope was in a person who behaved kindly because their hope was in God. Her hope was in a person. Naomi's hope was not just that the laws about redeeming property for someone related to you would just save her. No, her hope was in a person who stepped up at personal sacrifice and redeemed her property for her. Her hope was in a person redeemer. Our hope is not in laws and ideas or philosophies. Our hope is in a person who came to redeem us. It's not a philosophy. It's not a theology. It's not some law or some moral code. Our hope is in Jesus, the person, the King. So don't let times like this separate you from the reality of who Jesus is so that we're just singing about the hope of Christmas. Instead of, no, the hope of Christmas is real and caked in dirt because hope gets up and acts and it moves and it does things. The one who lived and died without sin wasn't afraid to dive into the dirt of sin. The one who took justice on his back wasn't afraid to take the darkness of our guilt on him. He paid the price to redeem us. He sacrificed himself. Hope raises dust because hope breaks the grip of sin, rescues us from the pit, digs in and pulls us up out and sets us on the path home. And that's why I love the story of Naomi and Ruth and Boaz and Rahab and all of the stories of Scripture, because they're not just, oh, here's a nice story to get you through a nice holiday time and feel good until January hits and you're in debt and you're fat and you don't know what to do with yourself. It's raw and it's real. Someone once asked Bishop Desmond Tutu, the famous South African bishop, about his book, Made for Goodness. They said, after all you've seen and endured, are you really as optimistic as your book says you are? Are you really optimistic? And he replied and said, I am not optimistic, not at all, no. I'm quite different. I'm hopeful. I'm a prisoner of hope. Because in the world, you have very bad people, and they look like they're going to win. All of them, he repeats, all of them have bitten the dust. I can just hear him saying it in that South African accent. Jesus is the only one who has risen up out of that dirt, out of that dust. We are not optimists, just choosing to think positively. No, we have a tangible, solid hope to grab hold of. His name is Jesus. And in him, our fears are met, which means they've been opposed. And our hopes are met, which means they've been satisfied. Look, I don't know what your hopes and fears are right now. Some of you might be frozen by fear the way Naomi was. You might right now feel like God's been out to get you, or feel like life has just ripped everything away from you and you're empty. That may be the place you're in. You might feel like you're not important, or you're a nobody, or there's nothing significant about your life, or that you don't fit where you are. The thing is, these stories prove that no matter who you are, you can be an incredible part of God's story of redemption in this world. And God can redeem wherever you are and whoever you are when you put your hope in him, put your hope in Jesus. Because if that was true for a prostitute living on a wall, barely getting by, it's definitely true for you. If that was true for a woman who lost her husband and sons and had no hope of having any kind of life, lost all of her property, far from home, then that's definitely true for you. If that was true for a young woman who'd lost her husband and was committed to her mother-in-law, traveled to a far country where she's not really accepted and embraced and doesn't really fit in, it's true for you. God redeems people. That's the story of the Bible. God redeems people. That's the story of a little town called Bethlehem. God redeems people. That's the story of Jesus. God redeems people. That's the story of Christmas. God redeems people.